I think they really have discussed it so finally. And
have they really? Well, we're now switched on, so we can talk perhaps. And you were saying that the Fabian Women's Group, you joined in 1911, didn't you, Dr. Fairfield?
Yes.
How did you come to join the Fabian Women's Group, really? How did it happen?
It happened in this way, that I'd been a year in Manchester as a resident in the what was then the very small Jewish hospital there, an excellent little hospital where I got a lot of valuable experience. And there I had joined up with the residue of the Women's Social and Political Union, the WSPU, that Mrs. Pankhurst and her daughters left behind when they went to London.
Yes.
When the movement became so large that they felt justified in taking a London office.
Yeah.
And I had joined up with them, and I had met a number of people from the Labour, various divisions about at that time of the Labour Party, the ILP chiefly. We didn't care for the SDF nearly so much. Mm. And I wanted to see what they were like in London when I came. And you've got to remember that you have to rethink entirely the kind of grouping, you see. And the fact that the Fabian Society had Shaw and Sidney Webb and a number of other well-known names at the time commended itself very much to the public. They were, whatever they might be called in the party, they were in fact some of the most popular members.
Yes.
And best-known members. And so I was very glad to join them. And they said, would I like to join the women's group? And when I was told that the people who were on it, I was only too pleased and delighted to meet them. And I made great friends with many of them, but it lasted pretty well all the rest of my life. But I left it when I, some years later, I got promotion inside the LCC, or the promise of promotion, and I knew that Herbert Morrison was then in charge. The Labour Party was just coming in. And Herbert Morrison was more scrupulous than the most old-fashioned clubland Tory about keeping political influence aside from one's work. And the fact that they were Labour and I was Labour, far from being to my advantage, would have been a serious handicap to me.
Mm-hmm. So you left.
You see. I gave it up. I had no time either. Mm-hmm. It was an exceedingly exacting job. Mm-hmm. When I joined the London County Council, because it was the thick of a movement such as we are getting now, that people talk as though it had happened for the first time, when there was a terrific rush to use new methods of social stability, social build-up, social relief. And I was very keen to use what one could of that in the schools for the children. I had no contact at that time, with the infant welfare centres. But I didn't mind that so much, because anybody is attracted by the prospect of the infant welfare centres and reducing the then very large infantile mortality. So I always chose, right from the beginning of my career, the things I thought were important but not popular, you see.
It's very wise. Yeah.
And I think, for example, I was able to do a lot for the, I haven't got the invitation here, But for the epileptics, see, people like that, there's just a lot of silly superstitions about. And about the mental defectives and mentally handicapped people, the great difficulty, I don't know if I explained this last time, but forgive me if I'm repeating myself.
Don't worry.
But for the first time, people were developing a tremendous conscience about that. But curiously enough, it was one of the, I fancy there are not very many things, juvenile delinquency was another, though, that grew up among the so-called bureaucratic officials long, long before it excited any interest or any hopeful action among the general public. And the people that were the great help to us for all things to do with children were the schools. People forget it now, but you see, the we'd had a school act since the 90s, I think it was 1998, separating or giving the education authority power to deal with the handicapped children.
Yes.
To there was nothing equivalent in any other legislation, and we were empowered to search them out, to make our standards, to ascertain them, to find out what was the best method of educating them, and to, through our care committees, to get them placed in industry or further institutions. And you see, that was an enormous field, and it was tremendously interesting. And although it's a fashion now, and is being carried to a most dangerous and unscientific length, to say that the handicapped child must be dealt with on the ordinary children, it was totally impossible then.
Yes, because classes were so big, you mean, and there were no facilities. Because classes were very big and because...
Because classes were very big, London had already been fined by the Ministry of Education for having dangerously large classes. And also because the real enemy, our real enemies, were these so-called eugenists. It was a great time under the Huxleys, I'm sorry to say, who were other great, otherwise great public benefactors, but Leonard Huxley, for example, played a most mischievous part in attributing everything practically exclusively to that.
To genetic fault. Failing. Genetic failing, you mean?
Yes.
Yes.
Mm. To genetic. And the, I used to go to the meetings of the Eugenic Society, and I think he told you the conversation seemed to me to be like that of imbecile children. And a man as intelligent as Leonard Huxley and others whose names are totally forgotten, but were then very much before the public. They would solemnly tell us that we were wasting our time in school in searching out the children, giving them special education. If we would only sterilize all the children of slightly lower intelligence who didn't come up to normal intelligence, we would abolish these lower grade inequalities in two generations. And because we absolutely, I'm proud to say, the Education Department of the London County Council absolutely refused to listen to this nonsense. And but we had a very difficult time. And so I have found that I was only too pleased to learn from the... Fabian Society, you see, how the general run of politics is going, because clearly this was being made a political issue.
Yes. So you wanted to outmaneuver the eugenicists by having political connections yourself,
yes.
Is that
yes.
right?
Very yes. much.
Yes.
And I found it was very extraordinary. The Fabians were not eugenists as a rule. They believed in what I believe in to this day, that it's a, what an American authority called a constellation
yes.
of different causes.
Yes, some of them social economic causes, it's some of them genetic.
Social economic and physical causes. And all these have got to be assessed if you're going to do justice to the individual child. And I would think that I like very particularly, both by in the Fabian Society and in the Lamakada Council, that they regarded our duty to the individual in the community, you see. And it was our duty to find out what was the best for that child. And when I'm told as though a great discovery of some wretched young cub reporter from the School of Economics that children should be put in the best grade of school would take them. I remember my first interview with the School Medical Officer of London. He said to a little group of us, there's one very useful guiding rule you could always have, that it doesn't matter whether it's the Conservative Committee or the officers, senior officers or not, we will all agree that every child is entitled to go to the best grade of school in which it can gain advantage. And that was in 1911, you see.
Did the eugenicists have any remedy for people already crippled? Were they not going to do anything about them? The eugenicists, you said...
Oh, the eugenists?
Yeah.
No, they weren't interested.
They just leave them.
And you'll be surprised how many noisy, as the phrase goes, vociferous amateurs who break into these social problems, you'll be surprised at their utter lack of humanity. It shocks the people like health visitors and school doctors and clerks, even clerks working in the office. I mean, we were so trained that that the administrative officers, who were then called clerks, in my department would come to me and say, here I found a file of papers, Dr. Fairfield, about this woman who's hopelessly crippled and bedridden, and she can't, no relatives now apparently, and she's been 3 years in this ward and she doesn't seem to have had a holiday. Couldn't we get her down to that seaside place of Margaret that is taking handicapped people? And I make the necessary arrangements so that neither I or the clerk would ever have seen the person, you see.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you're dealing with things the size of London, we saw as many as we could, pick out fundamental basic principles, you see, like that, that anybody who's been a long time in a hospital board is probably intensely bored, and what can you do about even getting them out in the sunshine in the lawn every afternoon?
But what did the Fabian Women's Group do, and what did they give you to do on the group when you joined it in 1911?
Well, it was mostly lectures and discussions. We were at that stage when, a very experimental stage, when we had not only to educate ourselves, but we had also to make contacts with a very large and totally ignorant group of workers. You will understand that this may sound snobbish, but it's just reflecting what was happening there. And you see, the English working people had never had, even to the extent the Scotch had, that I was accustomed to in Scotland, responsibility and interest in education. And education, largely owing to the tactlessness of the churches and a number of probably very complicated medical sociological causes,
yes.
they felt that it was a sort of us and them thing, you see. And they felt that education was something that was imposed from above.
Yes.
And I remember when I was still in the Fabian Group and working with them actively, we had the one of the education acts, I forget which it was, had come along, and it said the children were to stay till 15, see. They had been 13 in the north, and 14 to most of the south of England, and they were trying to raise it to 15. And if they were handicapped, who were slowly developing and who needed very special care, they could be legally kept till 16 if there was any prospect that they would improve or be able to use this knowledge. Mm. And one of the things that, the kind of thing that I could tell the Fabian group, that people didn't realize to what extent now even very rudimentary reading and writing and number, we called it, we hadn't invented the word numerates then, and the people at that low grade couldn't get a job and might be quite useful workers, but because the boy couldn't read the addresses on the envelope, he couldn't even get a job as a shop boy if he had to deliver the goods on Saturday, you see.
So were you a sort of expert, a medical expert?
Yes, we
on
found
the
out these things for ourselves.
Yes,
and they were in the group. I don't think there was any woman doctor who was engaged in that kind of active work at all. Well, we had Dr. Ethel Bentham. And she was rather grim, but very conscientious lady. But her experience was entirely with the working class general practice.
Yes.
And she was very useful, and I learnt a lot from her, and I hope she learned something from me, you see. We had to be approaching these problems from half a dozen different avenues, some of which had never been explored before. And so we were able to, I remember it was one of the rules in the Fabian Society that if you had a very popular and posh lecturer like Webb or Shaw, or who was the man who lived at Eltham, the husband of Nesbitt,
oh,
an awful scoundrel.
Clark, you mean?
What?
William Clark, Bland, Hubert Bland.
He was a man who had a row with Greg Rouse with H.G. Wells in the society. I can't remember.
I can't remember off hand.
You would know his name,
today. Yes.
And
Not Graham Wallace.
Graham Wallace had very little to do with the women's group.
Yes.
But he was, of course, a simply invaluable person.
Mm.
And he was a powerful figure in the LCC and formed a link, sort of link between us, between us and the practical problems of administration. He was very good. But I'm thinking of some of these very crazy eugenists.
Yes.
What was I saying about
them? Well, you were saying that at Fabian meetings where there was a very popular speaker.
Oh, yes, yes. Mm. where there was a very popular speaker, like one of the half dozen, it was the rule that his chairman, who had to keep the meeting going from half an hour, for a quarter of an hour, had to one of the junior and unknown members of the group or the executive. And it was an extraordinarily good meeting, a good rule, extraordinarily good rule, because he got to, you see, there was no sort of elite inside the group of people that you couldn't argue with or ask questions
yeah.
to, you see. And they would come to you. I remember Shaw appealing in that sort of way to me over a number of school questions dealing with school hygiene and working class children and the attitude of parents with their children when their children were going to work. And having a most serious discussion with some very able and quite important people, because I've been put in the chair for his lecture, you see.
So he gave you experience, really, of speaking and self-confidence.
Absolutely.
Mm.
And the sort of level that was worthwhile giving to people, you mm. see. Ever, they were always very... Shaw and Webb were... And Attlee,
oh, yes.
Major Attlee was... then one of our very silent but extremely valuable members of the executive. And did I tell you that I made the surprising discovery then, a lot of people never knew about Attlee, that he was a man of the utmost self-sacrifice and sort of generous humanity. I remember... I used to go be in the room, common room, when Shaw or Attlee were opening their letters, see. And very often they were sort of semi-disguised begging letters from young men who wanted to be writers or in some way wanted to get into the new socialist political groups. And just hadn't any money and was sometimes terribly short just for a time. And they used to write to these bigwigs that were there, and they'd enter into a solemn discussion. Did they know the young man? Oh, well, all right, he can have a fiver, tenner, you see, or we'll tell him when he's more like someone who recommend cheap lodgings or things like that. And they were extraordinarily good and kind. And I remember Attlee and his wife went and lived down in the what was then the settlement.
Oh, yes, settlement.
At Toynbee Hall. Barnett settlement, mm. yes. Mm. Went and lived there, you see.
Yes.
And... I remember Alderman Pease saying to me, when I said, I wonder they don't, that they really find this an interesting place to live. And he said, I'm very glad they're there. Attlee, you know, he's the sort of chap, he's very sensible some ways, but he'd give the shirt off his back. And there are a lot of knowledgeable people there. Who would tell him not to waste his money on a wrong one, you see, that sort of thing. And but I remember the enthusiasm with which old Pease spoke of Attlee and his personal kindness.
But can you tell me how many people were on the Fabian Women's Group then? Was it a large group? I mean, and what sort of group was it?
I can't remember who were on the executive. You could very easily find. I was on the executive for 8 years, I think, very extraordinary. And I got put on simply because I was a doctor. Almost directly I joined.
Did you really?
And they had Hayden Guest. But Hayden Guest was a little bit of a butterfly. For one thing, and another thing, he was engaged in a curious job. It was he who built the present building of the British Medical Association.
Houston.
Houston.
Yes.
And I forget what it was intended for. It was intended, I think, for some socialist purpose. And simply very largely because of inexperience in giving out contracts. And also the fact that the war broke out when it wasn't finished. And there was never any prospect of getting the money again, you see. The contractors firm couldn't had to get on with it. Hayden Guest, I think it was he who arranged the sale to the British Medical Association, whom, of course, it was too much too big for, but they were able to it was invaluable for other learned societies in that district.
But, can you remind me what you came down from Manchester to London, and you were working in which hospital when you came down in 1911?
I wasn't in a hospital. I was working. I got one of the jobs they were making on the LCC.
I see. Yes.
For a school doctor and general medical officer.
So, did the Fabian Women's Group have branches then, or did you just go to one place, or how did it work?
I don't know. I don't think they ever had anything as formal as a branch. Mm. I couldn't swear to it.
Mm.
There were a number of very good women from the Labour Party. Some of the early women in the Labour Party who did most useful work and were able to follow up the Pankhurst success as outdoor speakers in Manchester. But I don't think we had a formal Labour women's group.
I see. So did you go to meetings then at some central place? Or how did it work then at the Fabian Women's Group? I mean...
Oh, the women's group used to meet in the Caxton... some of the larger meetings were in the Caxton Hall.
Oh, were they?
And in the Fabian offices, you see. The Fabians had a good office by that time.
Mm.
They had very sensibly taken a large office which allowed a large number of several meetings to go on at once.
So you got onto the committee quite quickly.
Yes.
And what did you do on the committee, Dr. Fairfield? Then just prepare for pamphlets and studies of subjects
and that sort
of thing. Yes.
The pamphlets had, of course, to have a well-known name behind them, you see. And they were still issuing a few of the pamphlets. And I also gave a good many lectures. I used to lecture, and I was... I had a very good carrying voice.
You
which
still
I'm
have.
Afraid I only hear the wreck of. that was a great blessing for outdoor meetings, you see. I used to take the chair for Sylvia Pankhurst for a time in Hyde Park. I didn't like her. She was very extreme, you know, and not really thought out and logical. The rest of her family quarreled with her violently, you know, Sylvia Pankhurst. She had a very good heart, but a very, very woolly head, indeed, indeed.
But what was the relationship between the Fabian Women's Group and the feminist movement? I mean, were they all feminists or suffragists or suffragettes?
How did it relate?
Really?
Oh, in the Fabian Women's Group,
yes.
I don't think anybody would have joined up who wasn't a suffragist. But there were not many suffragettes there because Mrs. Pankhurst was then making an enormous number of recruits, but mostly She made such a point, as I think I told you last time, and how wise she was, of keeping it as a neutral subject until we got the vote, you see, that the woman who would be been very keen on joining the ILP or the up in Manchester or one of the other smaller groups, they wouldn't want to move on, you see, to her, and they generally, in fact, a great number of them failed entirely to realize the importance of the vote, as you would expect from what's happening now, you see, with these many violent sort of direct action people. And they're really useless, completely useless, unless they could see that you must have, in a civilized community, you must have a vote, and you must use constitutional means, unless you are being specifically excluded or deprived of the any of the other methods of social change.
Yes, yes.
You see.
Yes, yes.
And there were quite a lot of squabbles. Many of the trade unions thought we were rather dangerous middle-class people who were intervening in a quarrel for our own sake. I think I told you about the man who kept on asking.
Said it was a middle-class hobby.
Yes, it said, yes. Saying it was a middle-class hobby.
Yes.
Did I tell you about in Scotland, some of the hecklers were extraordinarily funny too, awfully funny. But the Scottish crowd was really better educated politically. Wasn't that curious?
Yes, that's the educational system.
The Midlands were the worst.
Were they really?
Yes, the Midlands were the worst. Mm. And no doubt some of the agricultural country. But the agriculture had, of course, a very much more separate life of its own. You couldn't quite compare them.
Yes.
In those days.
Because you had been an anti yourself at first, hadn't you? And then you changed at Edinburgh.
Yes, exactly. I'd been brought up. My father was an old-fashioned sort of Herbert Spencerian, rigid economist. And he wrote very well about it. He was very great on some useful kinds of freedom. And in Australia, he'd been very useful to the Melbourne Argus for a time. And then some people took exception to his views in supporting the Catholic schools, for example. He was very anti-Catholic. He came of a violently anti-Catholic family. But in Ireland, you know, the terrible black Protestants. But he did see the importance of keeping, giving the parent power, much more power than the socialists envisaged. Of dictating the education of their children, at the same time encouraging them. He wanted the Catholic schools modified, you see, to give the children a much wider, everybody, including the priests.
But why do you think, why was your father anti-suffrage, do you think? What made him anti-suffrage?
Oh, you'd be surprised at the people who were, just as the people of the present day who are so violently against a woman's lib or anything, some of these unfortunate people who never got much advantage for it, been held that up. Surprising how many people, after all these years, have no promotion for women and no pay, and the men think it's quite right.
But how
it's a natural sort. He thought it was an unnatural thing.
Did you actually come across a lot of anti-suffrage feeling among doctors?
I don't know that I discussed it. I didn't work very much with doctors on that. Oh, I see what you mean. Oh, the same sort of thing occurred. Yes, there were a number of incidents, of course, through my life, but I don't want to dwell on them because in which one was simply regarded as fair game for any dirty trick by most surprising people. But you try to forget about that. And there were so many of the men then who were beginning to be very generous and fair-minded about it. One rather concentrated on the positive side, you see, rather than what one hoped was disappearing.
I've noticed that doctors often are leaders in opposing suffragette meetings and so on, particularly medical students. They often interrupt suffragette meetings and so on. Why do you think that is?
The militants, of course, I think it was they just wanted a row. They knew nothing about it and didn't care anything about it. But it was it was an excuse for the for an outing. Really, we didn't regard it, their opposition, as particularly serious.
Yes.
We regarded it as very wrong, the opposition that women had met in the medical profession, you see. But that didn't run on political lines.
But there's another dimension of it, isn't there, in the way that doctors have a hold over women, men doctors have a hold over women, through their control of the whole profession, really. I mean, particularly in gynaecology and midwifery and things like that, you know.
Oh, yes. I'm sure you're right. I'm rather thinking of how my own particular course didn't run, that I tried to avoid confrontations, you see, of that side. Mm. But if you were taking, you're quite right, if you were taking a wide view of the whole thing, the medical profession was, on the whole, against this, what they called emancipation of women in any particular area. And I was lucky that I met comparatively little of it. It was very unpleasant when I did meet it. And, of course, there may have been much more than I knew or guessed, but
it wasn't a hindrance to you personally very much, really, you think?
I beg pardon?
It didn't hinder you personally very much.
Oh, I think it did a bit, good bit.
Mm.
Oh, yes.
Mm.
And I was lucky that I got to come. It was really owing to the fact that the chiefs of Frederick Mingus and then Dr. William Daly, the two chiefs under whom I worked, the medical officers of health, they were both very pro-women, you see.
Mm, I see.
So we were lucky in that respect.
Would you like a drink of water?
Yes, I think I would.
About religion, really, because you were in the Church League, weren't you?
Yes.
Suffrage, and I'd like to ask you about what happened later in your religion, because you became a Roman Catholic later, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, I did.
And that relates to your attitude on birth control and eugenics.
It was again just as the eugenists have been a frightfully foolish and stupid body.
Mm.
We were all against the sterilization. That was one of the things. I mean, even the most Protestant of us. I don't know a single doctor who worked with the LCC who, we found some afterwards in the municipal hospitals when we took them over, but not those from County Hall that was in favour of sterilisation. And that was the first thing. We were also, owing to our social experience, we were very much against euthanasia because we had our social workers found some very nasty cases where a so-called mercy killing. Remember a terrible case of a child. In fact, I think I told you about it. Who was drowned by the father in his bath. And in which the social workers who'd been visiting the home and had known the child since its birth, and knew both the parents and their reputation, and they were simply furious and horrified because they were clear cases of murder for gain.
Yeah. The child was insured, was it?
We knew what an appalling row there would be if we tried to bring it out as an issue. Can't you imagine News of the World people having a gorgeous time, you
see? Absolutely, yes, yes.
And
I changed the tape.
The